Welcome this morning two high school groups. One is from Seymour High School. Would those students please stand? Welcome to you all. You may be seated.
What's the home of the hammer, do you know?
Pardon?
Seymour is a home of the hammer.
That's what I told them. I spoke to them. Home of the hammer. One of you has something to say. Would you say it to everybody, please? To me.
You know, it's just mentioning that Seymour is known as the home of the hamburger. So it's glad to have you.
Claims to fame, I'm sure.
No, we like hamburgers.
A James Madison Memorial High School. Those students please stand. You may be seated. Thank you for coming. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to attend an oral argument. If they agree to come, they're given copies of the briefs, the case that the students will hear. They may engage in various activities relating to the case. And then when they come, they meet with a justice of the court, usually at lunchtime. And I'm told that the Seymour High School and James Madison Memorial High School students met with Justice Bradley at lunch, along with other students that were here in the morning. The discussion is had about the procedures of the court in taking and hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. And it's too late to tell you now, but I will anyway. You were all cordially invited to attend that session. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will now call our last case for today, and for the November sitting, 06-AP-1573, 06-AP-2290, Henry J. Cryer versus Donald N. Viglione. Representing Viglione and Richard Krause is Ward Richter, Mr. Richter.
May it please the court, Mr. Haig, Mr. Johnson. I will be taking the initial argument on behalf of the defendants petitioners. Mr. Johnson will be putting the toothpaste back in the tube and taking the rebuttal. We are here, as you know, of course, about a case in which damages are being claimed as the result of alleged thefts, allegedly committed by Michael Viglione. As with any commercial litigation, this case is now produced tens of thousands of pages of documents. And as with most commercial litigation cases, despite that vast volume of information produced, the really important documents are few in number. In fact, I believe there to be 6 pages of the record that are of real significance to the court's consideration of the issues raised by this appeal. If you'll please indulge me, those 6 pages include first, I believe, page 52 of the petitioner's joint appendix, which is the plaintiff's expert's summary of the fraud audit that was conducted after the suspected theft from EOG Environmental and the other companies. At page 52 of the appendix, what you will see if you look at it is a summary of Mr. Schultz's review of the accounting records, and it shows it with just a brief review of it, that a total of $1.28 million, according to Mr. Schultz, were taken by Michael Viglione over a period of years. That $1.28 million was taken, according to their experts' analysis, entirely from EOG Environmental. That same single sheet of paper shows two categories of theft, allegedly from a sister entity, EOG Disposal, $4,000 allegedly having been taken in the form of checks written for personal expenses, $3,000 for credit card, or cash advances, rather. So a total of $1,280,000 from Environmental, $7,000 from Disposal, nothing taken directly from the third of the three entities, Vilcry Investment, and nothing taken from Henry Creer. That document is the document, out of all of the documents produced in the case, that really set us on the course that brings us here today. The next document that I think is of note is found at page 28 of the joint appendix. This is another page from Mr. Schultz's report, and it is on this page that he lays out the corporate entities involved and their ownership. Environmental is a corporation. There were four owners. Of those four owners, two were the predominant but minority owners, Mr. Creer and Mr. Viglione, who each owned 47.17% of the stock in that corporation. Disposal is identified as a separate freestanding corporate entity owned by but two individuals, those being Mr. Creer and Mr. Viglione, equal owners. And the third corporate entity is a limited liability corporation, Vilcry, also owned by Mr. Creer and Michael Viglione, 50-50. The third document that I think is of significance is the first page of the settlement agreement that is found at appendix page 1. That document is important because it makes clear that on the date of the prior settlement between Henry Creer and Michael Viglione, where they divided these three corporations and their interests in them, that date January 31, 2003, I quote, Creer agrees to assign, transfer, and convey all of his common stock in Environmental to Viglione. End quote. That is significant because as of that date, more than 2 years before Mr. Creer and the other plaintiffs filed their suit, Mr. Creer abandoned all interest whatsoever in Environmental, the company that had lost $1.28 million. It is significant because it makes clear, as did the summary of the corporate entities, that neither Vilcry Investments nor Disposal ever had any ownership interests of their own, no ownership interest of any kind, in Environmental. Neither of them accordingly had anything to convey through the settlement agreement. The other thing that is significant about the settlement agreement is that it contains no language of any kind assigning from Environmental to Mr. Creer or to Vilcry or to Disposal any right to proceed with any claim of any kind owned by Environmental. Next, appendix page 6 is the first page of the release entered into between and among Mr. Creer, Michael Viglione, and these entities. The Court of Appeals noted that the release expressly reserved to the releasors, Mr. Creer and the two entities that he was taking with him, their right to pursue claims against accountants. That is significant for two reasons. First of all, it's significant because we are not here claiming that there was a release of the claims against our clients. That document is not significant because it is a release. It begs the question whether there were any claims owned by Disposal, Vilcry Investments, or Henry Creer to be released. The release is significant again for what it does not say, because again, like the settlement agreement, there is no language in the release that purports to be an assignment of claims from environmental to any of these other entities. That brings us to appendix page 57. At the top of the page, there is the plaintiff's answers to our interrogatories, specifically our interrogatory number 2, which asked, do you claim that there was any document constituting an assignment of environmental's rights to sue anyone, assigning those rights to the plaintiffs? They answered saying, nothing other than the settlement agreement. There is nothing in the settlement agreement constituting an assignment. We have consistently maintained that there has been no assignment, and there has never been any disagreement with that. The last document of note is found at appendix page 45. This is a page from Mr. Schultz's second expert report. Before I talk about that page where he sets forth the methodology for determining the damages that they're claiming, it is important to know the procedural status of this case as of the time that summary judgment was granted. Judge Kremers granted our motion for summary judgment on March 27th of 2006. This was 6 months after the plaintiff's deadline for disclosing experts, expert reports, and identifying special damages being claimed. By the time we get to the hearing on summary judgment and the court's ruling, we have both sides disclosed all experts, all expert reports, all special damages. All of the depositions of the experts and the parties have been concluded, and in fact, discovery is closed. As of the date that the court grants summary judgment, there is but one thing left to do. In the event the court had denied the motion for summary judgment, we were going to have a scheduling conference, set a trial date. This case was going to go forward as of the date that summary judgment was granted, based on the theory of damages, the allegations of the complaint as they existed at that time. Looking at the methodology used by Mr. Schultz to calculate the damages.
Counsel, before you get to damages, it seemed to me that many of the references that you pointed to in the appendix go to ownership interest, didn't sign this document, we're not a part of this document or that document. What about the premise set forth in Citizens Bank case that talked about no need to have privity? We conclude that the absence of privity alone should not bar negligence actions by relying third parties against accountants. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. This court, Justice Abramson, writing for the majority in the Bowen case, abandoned Justice Cardozo's majority decision in Paul's Graph. At that time in Bowen, this court embraced the notion that any party having or undertaking an action which foreseeably could cause harm to another owes a duty. The Citizens Bank case, the Chevron case that have been cited, talk about the right of the owner of a cause of action to pursue that claim against someone who owed them a duty, breached it, and caused them damages. With the same breath in which we abandoned the zone of danger analysis of Justice Cardozo in the majority and embraced in its place the concept that I've just alluded to, the concept that anyone who does something that foreseeably could cause harm was a duty, we imposed limits on that duty. We said in that case, for reasons of public policy, even though it is foreseeable in this day and age that if I am negligent in driving my car and cause grievous injury to a child, and even though it is foreseeable that that child might be raised by an aunt or an uncle, we are not going to permit that aunt or that uncle to make a claim for damages, even if they were standing there and saw this happen. For public policy reasons, at the same time we grossly expanded the range of duty, we constrained it. We have similarly constrained the idea that simply because there is a duty owed, there is a right to make a claim for damages. For example, by statute in the wrongful death case, the statute clearly sets forth the right to make a claim for wrongful death of another, but we only permit lineal heirs to bring those claims. And ultimately, bringing us back to your question and the facts of this case, we have the derivative shareholders statute chapter set forth in chapter 180. And we know from the court's decision in Rose versus Shantz that even where there has been a direct injury to a corporation, which clearly means that each shareholder in that corporation is suffering a loss because the value of the corporation is diminished, we take the position by statute in this case that the stockholder cannot bring their own claim to recover for those damages. Instead, we give that claim to the corporation and the corporation alone.
Court of Appeals here, and I think a couple of times in their opinion, indicated that they didn't view any of these as shareholder derivative actions.
The Court of Appeals decision was flawed in many respects, that being prominent among them. You don't have to take my word for this proposition. I believe the Rose versus Shantz case says that for us. And that's Wisconsin law, but it's Wisconsin law in the context of a dispute between a shareholder and the directors of the corporation in which he held stock. I can give you a case that that addresses the same issue even more close to the facts of ours, an accounting malpractice case. And it's a case that I take from the plaintiff's brief on appeal. It is Gemstar. Gemstar, the facts in Gemstar were basically these. There was a period of time in the United States where we offered tax incentives for foreign corporations to invest in American real estate. And according to what was alleged in the Gemstar case, a British Virgin Islands entity was set up for the purpose of taking advantage of this tax break to buy property in Arizona. The property quickly appreciated and was sold. The claim was that the accountant who was handling the advice to the American individual who served as the local presence for the British Island Corporation had committed malpractice, participated with the local American individual in defrauding the British Virgin Island Corporation and its stockholders. The stockholders brought suit, as well as the corporation, against the accountant, claiming that the accountant was liable for a series of misdeeds, including ordinary negligence, breach of fiduciary duties, misrepresentations, essentially the same sort of claims that we have here. That case went to trial, and at trial, the jury returned a verdict finding in favor of both the corporation and the shareholders. There was an appeal raising the question that we have here, that being whether the shareholders had standing to pursue that claim.
I have a question. You gave the general rule, and I agree with it, as you stated it, that the corporation has the cause of action. Shareholders may be hurt because if the corporation is hurt, the shareholders are hurt. But there's another general rule, as I understand it, where the wrongful acts, and here the alleged wrongful acts of the accountant, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Where the wrongful acts are not only wrongs against the corporation, but are also violations by the wrongdoer of a duty arising from contract or otherwise, and owing directly to shareholders. Individual shareholders can sue in their own right. And the quote is from Fletcher on corporations. But in Marshfield Clinic versus Dagey, 269 Wis 519, quote, if wrongful acts are not only wrongs against the corporation, but also violations by the wrongdoer of a duty arising from contract and owing directly to him, to the shareholders, then the stockholders may sue on their own behalf. I understand this case, and it's not easy to understand. The suit by Mr. Cryer is based on the fact that Mr. Cryer hired this accounting firm, an accountant, to do his tax returns, to give him the benefit of their wisdom on various things. And his claim is that the accountant owed him a duty, an accountant-client relationship. The accountant also had the, is it a brother? The brother has a client, and the corporation has a client. Cryer is alleging, as I understand it, that the accountant should have known on the basis of doing the returns for the corporations and for the brother that something was amiss, approximately $1.2 million amiss, and that Virtue Krauss had a duty to tell him, warn him, deal with him. You know, we haven't gotten to trial yet. This is a general pleading. And had he been appropriately advised when the accountant knew or should have known, he would not have suffered damages. Now, I'm going to get to what the damages are. That's, for the moment, a different issue, I think, although they are interrelated. But that's his objection is not like Bowen, which was a tort case and a duty. It was a contract relationship, an attorney, an accountant-client relationship, and there's been a breach of a duty. It's a malpractice case.
So let's assume, Your Honor, that there is someone out there who would testify that the accountant doing the books for environmental and being charged with knowledge of these thefts has not only the right to share with a totally different client.
That's right. Right.
But the obligation to share with that client.
And that may not be. But
right.
That's not the way this is being thought out.
No. What then is Mr. Cryer in that situation, assuming Virchow Krauss goes to him and says, we know of another client in which you have an interest having this problem. What is he going to do? What is his damage that he has standing to claim?
Okay.
We aren't running from the fact that we have a duty to anyone that we foreseeably harm, whether it's contract or otherwise.
So let us just suppose that we do have a contract, and that the allegation is breach of, you want to call it fiduciary duty under the contract, you want to call it malpractice under the contract, doesn't matter. And that's what Cryer is objected to. So it seems to me on the face of that, you've got a good lawsuit. Now the question comes, what are your damages? It seems to me that there you say he doesn't have any individual damages. The corporation has been hurt. The corporation value is down. His value as a shareholder is down. But he has to sue derivative. He can't sue derivative because he already got rid of the stock. Right? That's your argument in sum.
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, I don't see why you can't argue on the other side, which is what the Court of Appeals did, which says, look, you've got a malpractice, fiduciary duty, I don't care what you call it, and his damages were reduced stock, which he suffered. He's no longer in the corporation, but he is suffering for his own damages. Your position is he can't do that.
It isn't what he's doing.
Okay, what's he doing?
He has abandoned that. And with all due respect,
how's he abandoned it?
He's abandoned it because what he has done is, through his expert witness, taken not the corporation through which he lost $1.28 million, because he no longer owns an interest in it, and the derivative action is lost to him.
Uh-huh.
How can he get millions of dollars? He's claiming almost $12 million here. How can he get $12 million of damages when the corporation with which he no longer has an interest is the only one that suffered any loss. And the way they've gone about trying to do that is by bootstrapping, circumventing the shareholder derivative law. They have taken the $1.2 million loss from Environmental, added it to the corporate existence known as Disposal, and the corporate entity known as Vilcry. Then, having constructed this fabrication, this construct of a new corporation, in which Mr. Creer has absolutely no ownership interest, they reduce that by what? By his 47.17% ownership interest in the corporation for which he can't make a claim. And so they take a non-existent corporation, give it the only source of damages that they have, which is the damages he can't claim as a shareholder in a corporation he abandoned, and then they take these hypothetical...
Counsel, doesn't the claim include some allegations which are supported, arguably, by the expert, Mr. Schultz's report, that it was also Disposal and Vilcry who suffered damages in the form of lost business opportunities, lost goodwill, etc. And so I think your point in regard to Environmental is very clear. But please address the other points in regard to Disposal and Vilcry.
Let's take General Motors Assembly Division in Janesville. It just closed down. Let's assume that it closed down because its accountants did a lousy job of advising them that the gas was going to go up in price and Chevy Tahoes weren't going to be a good investment anymore. Now, are we going to let Lear Corporation that makes seats for the Chevy Tahoes and just had to close down because GMAB is closing down, bring a lawsuit against General Motors accountants? Are we going to let the cafeteria across the street from GMAB that was dependent on the workers coming over on their lunch breaks, are we going to let them sue General Motors accountants? It's foreseeable.
So what your response to that question seems to be incorporating by reference is the separate nature of the corporate identities in this case.
Precisely.
But unlike the lunch counter across the street from the GM plant in Janesville, and unlike Lear, who may make a number of components that go into those vehicles, isn't there an interrelatedness in regard to the three corporate entities here, which is inopposite or arguably much different from the hypotheticals that you've just discussed?
It's a matter of degree, Your Honor, and what we're talking about is taking bad facts to make bad law. I would note that the same damages that their expert is using to make damages for Henry Creer, are the damage, which is Environmental's loss, are the damages that he's trying to use to give losses to Disposal and Vilcry.
Right. The damages may or may not have relationship to the claim to what might be proven or borne out. But please address that. Do you concede anyway that the three corporate entities, although separate corporate structures, did have a certain interdependence?
There's no question that they were interrelated businesses, but they don't have identical shareholders, and Disposal didn't own any part of Environmental, Vilcry didn't own any part of Environmental, and none of them have damages without the alleged theft of that $1.3 million from this other entity.
So every damage for Environmental is the source of the damages or the foundation for the damages for the other. I thought there was $7,000 that the trial court left standing that plaintiffs had the right to sue for.
It was that same $7,000 that I mentioned at the very outset of my remarks.
Okay, so you're not disputing that they can go back and have a trial for $7,000. You just don't want them having a trial on Environmental's losses based on any of the claim set forth in the complaint.
And we aren't quibbling. Not only can they claim the $7,000, they can claim the consequential damages. If they had to borrow money because they lost that $7,000, the interest on that borrowed money would be part of their claim.
Right.
But that is because that's damage to them. And if I could just, I've got the red light. Ultimately, the way they characterize the loss that they're claiming is not, Justice Gableman, as a loss to Disposal. It is not as a loss to Vilcry. It is characterized as a loss, it is called the Creer loss. It is called, they keep referring to the environmental entities and the environmental enterprise. There is no such thing. It is a construct that they have made to try to get around the problem.
I understand the intertwined nature, I think we all do, of the claim. But, and that was the purpose of my question, is to sort them out as to why shouldn't Creer, as the now sole owner of those two entities, be able to pursue the claims for losses that they allegedly suffered as a result of your client's negligence?
Because the shareholder derivative statute would not permit him to even bring claims in his own name for disposal or for vilcry. They have, those corporations, if this court decides that they have claims, could bring them.
And weren't they named as plaintiffs in the
yes.
complaint?
Yes.
Keith, may I ask one question? With respect, maybe this is overly simplistic, so help me out if it is. But when I take a look at the complaint, you have Henry Creer bringing the complaint. That's January 2005 or so. Previously, you have the settlement agreement from 03, January of 03. So 2 years previous, they settle out. And the way they decide to settle out is environmental is sold from Creer to Villion. Disposal is sold from Villion to Creer. And Vilcry is sold from Villion to Creer.
Yes.
So when he brings the complaint 2 years later, he brings the complaint on behalf of the new entities that he formed, Disposal and Vilcry, essentially becoming Badger, Disposal Badger Investments, right? Because he's a shareholder and has ownership interest in those two entities that he previously settled and acquired from Villion, right?
So far, with one exception, in fairness to Mr. Creer, I don't believe Badger Disposal and Badger Investments are truly new corporations. I think he renamed.
Okay.
So I think there's a flow of ownership there.
That's fine. But the point that I'm trying to reconcile is, and maybe it's just too simple, you have this third entity, the environmental entity, that was sold from Creer to Villion. So he relinquished 2 years previous his stock and ownership interest in that. And then you take a look at page 52 of the expert's report, which outlines the damages, and it has only $7,000 damages that are attributable to Disposal, if you add the four and the three. And then the bulk of the damages are for environmental. And to bring a derivative lawsuit, don't you need to be at least a shareholder at the time you file your complaint 2 years later? And he wasn't.
Precisely, and that is the, I've forgotten the term, concurrent ownership rule or the contemporaneous ownership rule.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that that wasn't overly simplistic.
No, it's okay. Not overly simplistic, and it's right on. Could I adjust your
process? If you prevail in every way you'd like to prevail here, what will happen in the trial court?
There will be a trial. As to the damages, the only plaintiff left standing is Badger Disposal, and Badger Disposal would be free to prove its all of its claims, including the $7,000 of damages that they suffered as a direct result of the thefts, and consequential damages flowing from the loss of that $7,000. That is Judge Kramer's holding.
Is that a contract claim or a tort claim?
It is. I believe they've pleaded 9 or 10 different claims. And
contract is not listed in the complaint unless there's an amended.
Then I stand corrected.
Is that subject to punitive damages?
There are claims for punitive damages. There are claims for attorney's fees as well. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, or Mr. Johnson will. Mr. Haig?
Thank you to the court, to Mr. Richter, Mr. Johnson. I'm Eric Haig. I represent Henry Creer, who is seated here in the front row behind me. Badger Disposal and Badger Investment Realty. I have tremendous respect and admiration for opposing counsel They're very good, very talented, very able, and they will do an excellent job for their clients. I disagree with what they've just told the court and what they're asking you to do in this case. I'll start with the question that Justice Prosser just asked counsel, and that is, what happens if you win, if the defendant gets everything you're asking for here? And I don't say this lightly, but I believe that the results would be dire. What we would be talking about are narrowing the scope of those who are protected from fraud and negligence. Not maintaining it, not expanding it, narrowing the scope of those who are protected, including individuals like Mr. Creer, corporations, banks, insurance companies, anyone who reasonably relies on an accountant.
Counselor, are there any damages, aside from the $7,000 to which defendants admit, that do not arise from environmental losses? I don't care what kind of a claim you're making, whether it's misrepresentation or conspiracy, or I think you pled about seven different things, but are there any damages aside from those $7,000 and the consequential damages to disposal that do not include or arise from environmental losses?
Let me try to answer that in two ways. We're not disputing that the amount of money taken out of disposal's account is limited to $7,000. What we would say is, yes, the damages to disposal are far beyond the $7,000 because we have alleged they suffered a diminution in value far beyond $7,000 as a result of money taken from environmental.
Well, but you see, my question was this. Are there any damages, aside from those seven, which do not arise from a loss to environmental? And if I understand your answer, it's no, there aren't any.
Well,
you may construct them in different ways, but can you identify any? I couldn't find it, and I looked for it. So.
I'll say this. The complaint includes an allegation that Mr. Creer individually lost income, incurred unnecessary debt, attorney's fees.
All that was related to the money that was stolen from disposal, according to what's in the complaint. If you want to point me to a paragraph, I would be pleased, because I really looked for that, because in summary judgment, we start with the complaint. And when I look at the complaint, I see damages, aside from this one section, which nobody's fussing about here, that the trial court said you can go back and try on. I see damages under many different theories, but they all involve or arise from the loss of environmental as a corporation. If you can show me where it is, you'd help me greatly.
Well, I'm referring to paragraphs 39 and 41 of the complaint.
Okay, gotcha.
And all I can say is, it's true that the money that was stolen came from environmental. But we're not saying that the only damage is the amount of money stolen.
I understand you're building on that. I understand it. But my concern is, can you get there, can you get to step two if you can't make step one? And I think you have a real problem with the derivative action and your client not being a shareholder at the time of the fraud, or whatever you label it, and at the time of the suit. And the statute requires both, as does a recent, well, not too recent, but Reed, which is a securities case that's almost on point. So I'm trying to figure out how you can get to step two, and I can't find a way for you to get to step one, is that you can have any claim based on the damages of environmental. So that's where I'm stuck, if you could help me.
Okay. And I don't have anything to say on that beyond what I've told you. I would like to respond to the comments you just made.
Sure.
In terms of the derivative shareholder statute, Chief Justice Abramson pointed out the holding in the Marshfield case, which has been echoed in many other cases, including Your Honor's decision, the Jorgensen case.
There was an individual right of that shareholder in Jorgensen to receive fees as a director because the corporation did not pay dividends. And when he was removed as a director, he had an individual right from the actions that occurred there, aside from any damage to the corporation. So that's not what you're telling me here. And I'm not seeing that here.
Let me back up a step.
Okay.
one of the premises to their position is disposal in Vilkir Creek cannot recover damages for the effects that the thefts from the environmental had on them.
Right. I think they're saying that. I agree with you.
That is what they're saying. They've said that at page 12 of their petition.
Right.
And that is essentially saying they can't recover for diminution in value as a result of what their own accountants did to a related entity of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
I would suggest that that is simply a cause question. We look at jury instruction 1500 and say, you're entitled to damages that you can show the defendant's conduct was a substantial factor in causing. We have put on expert proof to say that those acts of taking money from environmental caused damage by diminution in value to disposal. It could not expand. It owned the valuable DNR permit, which was a valuable asset. This idea that the whole diminution in value calculation is based on the diminution in value of environmental is simply wrong. They were lumped together, that's true. But if we accept Your Honor's argument or proposition that, let's say that Henry Creer had to comply with the derivative shareholder statute,
yep.
And let's say that despite the fact that he was owed an individual duty and pursuant to Marshfield, that would be an exception. Let's take that out and say he doesn't have standing to bring that claim for any damage associated with environmental.
Right.
You still would have the diminution in value to disposal and to Vilkri as a result of the acts that were done, if we can prove to a jury that there was a causal relationship there. And at this stage, they have put on no proof to defeat that claim. They have put on nothing to say, no, those entities were not damaged. Those entities did not suffer diminution in value. The summary judgment methodology requires that to be defeated. It hasn't been defeated.
Well, first you have to have a claim for relief. That's the first step. And I'm stuck on the first step, whether you're not alleging basically just a derivative action. And on the pleadings, all I had before me was the complaint. I would say that you don't really have anything to say here as a legal claim for relief.
Well, I hear you saying that with respect to Mr. Creer's claim, but with respect to disposal and Vilkri, as Justice Gableman pointed out, or at least I think was getting at, they have alleged and have their own damage. I don't know why those companies who have brought their own claims and who are plaintiffs would need to bring a derivative action. I mean, they are the parties in this case. And if we simply take the defendant's rationale that the current ownership interest is what governs, and so since Henry Creer owns 0% of environmental now, that's what governs. Well, now he owns 100% of disposal in Vilkri. You would simply recalculate the damage, taking what 100% of Vilkri and disposal would have been worth but for the bad acts, compared with what he has now. The result is not to dismiss the case. The case hasn't been defeated.
See, I think you still have to prove the damages to environmental in order to take the second step. And, you know, under Reed versus Reed, which is a 1996 case, under Rose versus Shantz, under the statutes, Chapter 180, you have to be a shareholder both at the time of the wrongful conduct and at the time you file the action. Now, when I look at the stipulation, it looks to me like your client was thinking about this lawsuit a long time ago because the actions against the accountants were specifically accepted on that particular date. So, you know, if you were arguing, hey, I settled for this claim for a whole lot less than I should have because you folks misled me, accountants, and I had a right to rely on the statements you were putting together, I would think you had a claim because you would be basing it on an independent action aside from damage to the corporation. So if he said, when I settled, I got a bad deal here because I relied on you, accountants, and I had a right to rely on you, I think you'd have a claim all day. It would have nothing to do with the actual harm to the corporation. But your claim has to have actual harm to the corporation, or you can't get to the second step. And that's where I'm having difficulties with it.
And, Your Honor, all I can tell you is that we have put on proof that these disposal and Vilkri suffered harm. And, in fact, I don't believe the defendants have even disputed that Vilkri and disposal suffered harm or diminution in value. What they've said is you can't recover for it, And I take them to be saying by the reliance on Picture Lake, you can't recover for it because it is too indirect. Now,
see, I thought their citation to Rose versus Chance was that you really lack standing to bring the foundational claim for your lawsuit. But maybe I misinterpreted their brief.
Well, my take on it is they're relying on Rose versus Chance for the proposition that Henry Creer's portion of the claim relating to his prior ownership interest in environmental, he was required to bring as a derivative claim. But, I mean, they have said in their petition, disposal in Vilcrete cannot recover for the effects that the thefts had on them. To me, that's
more like a public policy argument.
Right, it's a tacit admission. They suffered damage. They suffered a diminution in value. It hasn't been challenged or defeated. They're saying you can't recover it. There is no Wisconsin authority for saying you can't recover that. To me, it's contrary to Citizens Bank. I think you have to overrule Citizens Bank in order to rule in their favor here. And, you know, we can start back in 1931 with the Osborne case. What damages are you entitled to as a result of the negligent act? You're entitled to all consequential damages naturally following from the injuries, whether reasonably anticipated or not. We've got accountants here who their own clients are saying, we were damaged by your acts.
I have a question for you. Suppose Mr. Cryer did not use Virtue of Krauss as his accountant. Used another firm. Only relationship to the Virtue and Krauss is that they were the accountants for the corporation from whom the embezzlement was made. Would you be here? Would Mr. Cryer be in the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
How come?
Under the Marshfield exceptions that Your Honor alluded to earlier, there are two of them. One, if the wrong arises from a duty owed directly to him. You're saying take that out of the equation. At least that's what I hear Your Honor saying in your hypothetical. They're not his accountants. The second exception, though, that allows you to bring a derivative claim is if you were affected in a way differently from other shareholders.
Okay, how was he affected differently than other shareholders?
Because Mr. Villione got the money. Mr. Creer did not. That to me, is the same as the, or at least analogous to the facts in Jorgensen.
Yeah, but suppose there were three shareholders, not two. Four. There were three here. Suppose there were four shareholders in this one. And there were. So he's in the same position as all the other three. And if you had a derivative action, it would be all the shareholders, including the one who did the embezzlement, but then they would be suing the embezzler. So then the embezzler would pay up. It would go to the corporation. The embezzler would get back not 100% of what he stole, but 47% of what he stole as a 47% shareholder if I got the right numbers in.
Well, I apologize. I'm not sure I followed that exactly. All the talk about hamburgers and toothpaste got me a little bit flustered to start with. So I think I understand your point, and all I can tell you is that these are his own accountants who owed him a duty that we believe applies under Marshfield.
I'm trying to figure out, if it wasn't the accountant duty, whether you would have a lawsuit
They were not his personal accountants.
Right, exactly.
And what I'm saying is the second exception, which is, are there two classes of shareholders that are created? Are all shareholders equally affected by this? As they were in Rose, or are there two classes of shareholders? And here I would say there are two. There are the haves and the have-nots. Haves and have-nots. Easy for me to say. And so I think the second exception under Marshfield, which is also recognized in other cases, Rose, Luther, is... Mr. Creer didn't get the money that was taken.
Counselor, but how is that any different than any other shareholder? Just forget that you got one shareholder that's apparently or alleged to be stealing money from the corporation. Just say they're all honest folks. You don't make classes by whether you got a thief in the corporation or not a thief in the corporation under Chapter 180 derivative actions to show you have something different. He have to have a legitimate right that you're exercising, and both of their legitimate rights have to be different. Here, if the money is taken and the person who took it is an honest, upright person, he's damaged the same way as every other shareholder. Why? Because it's the corporation that's actually damaged, not the shareholder. They're only damaged indirectly by virtue of a lessening of the value of the corporation.
I think what Your Honor just said sort of demonstrates the absurdity of saying that this is a good thing for public policy. The man with unclean hands would be recovering a proportionate share of the diminished value damages here.
You did that in your settlement. You could have sued him for conversion all day long. You didn't sue him for conversion. I mean, you did your deal, you settled it out, you traded the corporations out, but if everything that's alleged is true and you really took $1.8 million out of your client's corporation, in which they both own the same amount of stock, you had a lot of different things that you could do. The corporation could have proceeded against him on a claim of conversion. You would have got it back. It would have gone to the corporation. The client would have gotten as much money as you can get back on it.
Certainly there are a lot of ways it could have been handled. Why it was or wasn't, I don't know. But the point now is it proper to enter summary judgment on the claims that we've brought here, and the claims haven't been defeated?
I'd like to pick up a thread of inquiry that was commenced by the Chief Justice. And that is, if we take the relationship, the professional relationship between your client and the accountant firm here, and the specific accountant, out of the equation, why isn't the standing, the respective positions of standing between the corporations, Bill Cree and Disposal, analogous to Mr. Richter's hypothetical concerning the GM plant? And you know, same situation due to the alleged negligence of an accounting firm which causes the closure of a manufacturing plant, then others who are affected, other business entities who are affected. Why would that not be on point?
Well, that's a big thing to take out, of course, the privity, the relationship of privity. But if we take that out, I think the question that Your Honor posed to Mr. Richter in response to his first answer is the answer. These were highly interrelated companies.
The question was the question.
Right. These were interrelated companies that were transferring money from one to the other, back and forth, paying employees. It's different than a capital.
But that begs the question that your client participated. I assume the record might have the decision was made at some point to divide these entities into three separate corporations. I mean, they were interdependent, but they were three separate corporations. And so I ask you, and I ask you not to respond with something that you inferred from one of my previous questions, but just tell me why you think it's different from what Mr. Richter sent out with the GM plant.
It's different from the situation of the GM plant because Virgil Krauss was the accountant who owed a duty directly to Mr. Currier Disposal and Vilcree.
Now, is there something in the pleadings that says Virgil Krauss was his personal attorney? Because accountant. Because what I'm finding is that they owed him a duty because he was a part owner of EOG Disposal, EOG Environmental, and Vilcree. But I didn't see them saying he was his personal accountant.
It is in there, Your Honor, not all.
Is it? Okay. If it's there, I can look for it. You don't need to take your time.
Perhaps number 51, the complaint, defendants owed a duty to their clients, Henry Cryer and his companies.
Well, I wanted an allegation that Virgil Krauss was Mr. Cryer's personal accountant because that's what's being represented. I just didn't see that allegation. But it's there. I'll find it.
It is in there.
Okay, thank you.
You have the January 2003 agreement between the parties. Could that agreement be attacked as induced by fraud? Some sort.
I hadn't thought of that. I think that's a good question, but I'll give you an honest answer that perhaps you don't hear very often. I don't know.
Good answer.
Well, you're obviously not suggesting then, or maybe you are, that the defendant in this case
participated in a fraud leading to that agreement. Is that right?
Well, fraud is of course what led the parties to the brink of insolvency, that forced the fire sale, the divorce, that necessitated that agreement. But I'm not saying the agreement in and of itself was a perpetration of fraud. In other words, that they were, you know, taking advantage of him in terms of the agreement. I think by all accounts, though, there's been testimony. I don't know how much of it is in the record in front of this court, but there has been testimony. It seems that parties agree that the split up was at least close to fair. Some people think maybe a little better deal for Mr. Creer. Some people think a little better deal for Mr. Viglione. The idea was to split up the companies and get rid of the mess so they could go on, which, if I may, in response to the public policy concerns that have been raised, it begs the question, what should Mr. Creer have done? I mean, should a person in a closely held corporation who knows that his business partner is stealing from him have to stay in that throughout years and years of litigation in order to preserve a current ownership interest so that he has standing to file a claim under the derivative shareholder statute? Or should he be allowed to get out? I mean, I know that there's another case pending before this court, the Knotts case, where they've briefed the issue of public policy and the derivative shareholder statute, and they've certainly made more lengthy and detailed arguments on that aspect of it than we have here. But there's at least an idea that in a closely held corporation, it doesn't serve the purpose it was designed for. Perhaps I'm getting away from the question you asked, but I don't think that there is an allegation that the January 31 settlement agreement was fraudulently induced, if that was Your Honor's question. I'm waiting for another question. And
one question that came to mind when I was reviewing the record, and I didn't see it. Why were the three entities originally set up? Why was the decision made to make them three different corporations?
Does the record tell us? The record does not tell us, and I don't know the answer. And
I'm not asking you to go beyond the record. I didn't see it, and
I've asked the same question
myself. Did your client make individual personal payments to Virtual Krause for work that they did for him?
Yes, and I believe that the complaint states the allegation that the plaintiffs paid Virtual Krause for the services performed.
I'm not talking about the plaintiffs. I'm talking about Henry Cryer.
Yes.
One person. Yes.
And he is one of the plaintiffs.
Oh, I understand that. That's okay. I'll look after oral argument.
Look at factual allegations 7 and 8. 7 says, Viglione supervised, prepared, and signed the enterprise's tax returns and financial statements, as well as the principal owner's personal tax returns.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
The enterprise and Michael Viglione.
7 and 8.
And then 8 says, this is not precisely clear. Viglione and Virtue Krause were paid a fee for all their services as described in their complaint. It doesn't say who paid the fee, whether the corporations paid the fee or they paid it individually. Although we probably can look at appendix number, let's see, at page 52 and see. Doesn't show that for Michael Viglione, they paid Virtue Krause from the corporation.
Is there any part of your damages that relate to an incorrect preparation of the personal tax returns for Mr. Cryer?
Well, in the sense that his income personally would have been different had there not been massive thefts.
But they didn't incorrectly prepare the return.
I would say that they are, because, well, I see what you mean. Were his own personal returns inaccurately prepared?
I'm trying to separate the people from the companies.
Sure. No, I don't have any evidence that his own personal returns were inaccurately prepared. One, perhaps what Your Honor is thinking of along that lines is, does he have personal reliance and that would lead to damage? And one thing I'd like to draw your attention to is paragraphs 10 through 15 of the complaint, mm-hmm. which allege very specifically personal reliance. And they discuss a 1999 meeting where Mr. Creer was concerned that the businesses didn't have any money. He was concerned that they had debt and weren't able to pay vendors. He had a meeting with the accountant, Donald Biglione.
Told him just to walk away, right? That there's no value here.
Dissuaded him from bringing in a board of advisors to look at the finances and try to convince him to walk away. Now, that was personal reliance. Those were fraudulent statements and concealments directed at him personally.
Mr. Haig, the Court of Appeals here found that there were genuine issues of material fact. Can you summarize those for me?
Thank you, Justice. I think what they were talking about is as to the amount of damages. As I said, the defendants haven't shown, they haven't defeated the claims that we've put out. They haven't said they didn't suffer damage. What they've said is essentially, we disagree with the amount of damages you are claiming. And that is, there's two parts to that. One is whether Henry Creer has standing to bring a claim individually. The other is, did Disposal and Vilcree suffer damage, and if so, how much? The difficulty here is that it's hard to tell exactly what the theory of the defendants is to grant summary judgment. They say, for example, since plaintiffs failed to show that they were entitled to the damages they are claiming, the trial court correctly granted summary judgment as to their claims. I don't know what that means, but it sounds to me like it means if you can't prove all of the damages you've alleged, you dismiss the claims. And I would say that perhaps the Court of Appeals recognized that's not the way to do it. An analogy would be in a personal injury case, if the court determined that due to the facts, the plaintiff could not recover for a future loss of earning capacity. But they still could recover for past wage loss. They still had pain and suffering claims. They still had medical bill claims. The remedy wouldn't be to dismiss the plaintiff's claims, to dismiss the suit. There are still questions as to the amount of damages available. The remedy would be to say, all right, you don't get to pursue your loss of earning capacity claim. And here I would say, if the court agrees, I think the Marshfield exceptions apply. But if the court agrees that Henry had to bring a derivative claim with respect to the environmental portion of the damages, and he can't, you still have a genuine dispute of material fact as to the amount of damages remaining that were caused by the accountants to their clients, Disposal and Vilcree. Yes, they were caused by thefts taken from environmental. But I would say that is not any further away in terms of remoteness, and I would say it's even closer than what was authorized in the Citizens Bank case. So I can guess that the Court of Appeals is talking about the material disputes of fact as to the amounts of the remaining, as to the amounts of all damages, because the Court of Appeals found that he was owed an individual duty and did not need to bring a derivative claim.
Are there genuine issues of material fact with regard to the negligence or the breach of fiduciary duty towards Disposal and Vilcree? Based on the allegation of allowing the theft of $1.2 million from environmental?
Well, Justice, certainly I know that these excellent attorneys will and have in depositions done a thorough job of questioning our experts about whether this was, in fact, negligent, whether they should have caught this or not. Mm-hmm. But for purposes of this motion, they haven't offered to the court proof to try to defeat the substance of those claims.
Do we take the allegations of the complaint as true, if not controverted? I don't know. That's an emotion to dismiss. What's the status? I mean,
well, I would say
I thought that the negligence and the breach of fiduciary duty is yet to be determined.
That's true, and for purposes of this motion, the court has to assume that we can prove all of that. I mean, I think in AccuWeb, that was what this court held. I mean, the claim, certainly when you resolve all of those issues in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, it's resolved in our favor, given the fact that they haven't challenged the substance of the negligence, the breach of fiduciary duty, the misrepresentation, the conspiracy to convert. That hasn't even been challenged at the summary judgment stage. So that has to be taken in our favor. I mean, we don't get to the step in the summary judgment methodology process where we have to, where we have to respond to them after having defeated the claim, because they never got to the step where they defeated the claim. They've simply said, you can't recover damages for disposal and vilkery as a result of the effect that the thefts from environmental had on them. They've pinned their entire case on the damages, saying, you can't recover diminution in value. Counselor, I don't know if that answers Your Honor's question.
Neither you nor opposing counsel have gone through your complaint claim by claim, and I guess it's opposing counsel's position that they're all derivative, so they don't need to. And is it your position, contrary-wise, that none of them are, so all of them stand? In other words, we don't need to look at your claim under 13401 or civil conspiracy or accounting negligence individually. We just take them all together as a lump. Either they're all allowed to proceed and whatever happens in the trial court happens, or none of them are allowed?
The latter. I think that they are either all allowed or not allowed.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Johnson.
Thank you. My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing on behalf of Mr. Villiolme to present this rebuttal argument. Mr. Villiolme would grab me in the hallway and throttle me if I did not make one thing clear. Although this motion assumes for purposes of the motion that there is at least a tribal issue of fact as to negligence or other wrongful conduct, my client absolutely denies it. There are factual issues all over the place on issues like whether Mr. Michael Villiolme ever did anything wrong, whether he did anything with regard to this corporation that was any different than what Mr. Prayer himself was doing with regard to this corporation, but none of those are material because of the posture this case is in before this court.
Counselor, is it critical that Virgil Krauss was the individual attorney of Henry Cryer as well as the attorney for the business, or does it not matter to your analysis at all?
It may be
accountant, not attorney.
Accountants,
thank you very much.
It may be ultimately at trial, and in all honesty, I've gotten a number of good ideas here as to issues to raise if we ever have to go back and try this mess. But insofar as this motion is concerned, it makes no difference whatsoever because we have never claimed on this motion that we didn't owe duties to Mr. Krier or that Mr. Krier wasn't entitled to sue. Those are perfectly valid issues and may someday have to be worked out. What we said on the motion for summary judgment is, assuming we had a duty to him, assuming we breached any or all of those duties, Justice Rogensack, that you referred to in the complaint, because this is not about the complaint, it's about the motion for summary judgment. What we said is, you have to prove damages you are allowed to recover. And this came up in precisely the procedural posture that Mr. Richter described. They had their chance to provide their expert reports. They had to submit special damages, and the court said, okay, now we have your expert reports. We know exactly what you claim for damages and how you claim you sustained them. And now we look at them and say, which of these plaintiffs have presented a claim for damages which is supported by expert testimony which the law permits you to recover? And what the trial court said, and which, with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, it is obvious from their decision they never understood, is that all he found is that, number one, this is a complicated damage case, and therefore you need expert testimony to prove your damages. That, I think, is undisputed. How could it be otherwise? Number two, your experts have set forth certain theories. They have set forth two theories of damages. One is Mr. Krier owned 47% roughly of a group of companies. We claim those companies without the theft were worth X million dollars. And what he was left with after the thefts and after his settlement and after all the dust had settled, is something that's worth Y million dollars. And Mr. Creer's ownership interest in this group of companies is $11 million less than it would have been if he still owned 47%. Now, I will tell you, as we said in our brief, there are problems galore with that approach, but they're not material here. What's material here is, can Mr. Creer, under Wisconsin law, come into court and say that because my ownership interest in a company or group of companies was reduced in value by acts of someone that I claim was negligent or acted improperly, I can recover those damages? And the answer, short and simple, is no, you can't. The Rose case says you can't. That's the claim of the corporation, because, of course, if he recovers it, Environmental can come back into court and sue us for the same damages. That's why the law says the shareholder can't sue, because the corporation has all the damages. The shareholder has a part. The law says the corporation sues, not the shareholder. That's the Rose case. That's the Gemstar case. There is no persuasive authority anywhere that says they get to sue because Mr. Creer's ownership interest declined. They chose, by their expert reports, by their special damages, by the case they chose to present, that that was Mr. Creer's personal damage claim, and it doesn't exist. There could be all kinds of other damages. All the things he talked about might be damages that Mr. Creer or someone like Mr. Creer might sustain. The problem is, under the expert reports they submitted to the court, under the scheduling order, under the special damages they submitted, under the theory they argued, they never said any of that. And so the court said, you had your chance to prove what your damages are, to put your contentions forth. You put all your eggs in the wrong basket. That basket doesn't exist for Mr. Creer. Therefore, Mr. Creer has no claim. The court then went on to Vilcry and said, you have presented no evidence of any damages for Vilcry. I agree. It is entirely possible Vilcry was damaged. And they had months and months and months and expert reports that thick, supplemental reports, in which to put forth some theory under which Vilcry was damaged. And they never did it. And the judge said, on a motion for summary judgment, when they say you haven't proven any damages, the plaintiff has to prove damages. You submitted no evidence of damages.
Mr. Johnson, are you saying that the private accountant here, that is Mr. Creer's private accountant, even if he were negligent or breach of loyalty, has not proved that Creer has not proved damages, because the only damages on this record show diminution of the value of the corporation.
Value of companies he owned a partial ownership interest in, the law doesn't permit that for damages. And I'm not saying he can't recover damages, and I'm not saying he doesn't even have any. I'm saying he and his lawyers chose not to prove that because they went for the big buck. They put this huge number out there because it was a simple, easy case they thought they could sell. The problem is,
how did they get from $1.2 million to $12 million?
God only knows. I took the deposition, and I will tell you, it's not in the record. It's a disputed fact, but the honest fact is, it makes no sense. And as a matter of fact, I could tell you, if we wanted to talk about this, and maybe someday we will, one of their experts admitted that the opinion he crafted is the one they told him to craft, even though it's not the right question. It's not the relevant question. He never valued Mr. Creer's ownership interest in this company. It admitted he didn't. So the whole number's mythical in the first place. But it doesn't matter, because that's not what we argued. What we argued is Mr. Creer is not permitted under the law to recover for diminished value of his investment in business entities, because the business entities have the right to bring those claims. And even if he somehow qualified for a derivative claim, he clearly doesn't, it wouldn't be his claim. He would be suing for the corporation's claim. So even this measure of damages, if it was a derivative claim, is not the measure of damages for a derivative claim. It would be 100% of the damages, but they never presented that either. What the court then did say is, since you have proven no legally recognized item of damages, maybe you could have. No one has ever said they couldn't have. We just said they chose not to. For Mr. Creer, and since you have proven no item of damages for Vilcry, maybe you could have. They might be there, but under the scheduling order, you didn't. We move to the last one, disposal. Aha, you did submit reports that provide a basis for a damage claim. It's $7,000, and what Judge Kremer said is, you can prove any damage to that company that's consistent with that damage report, you have your day in court.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Haig, and thank you, Mr. Richter, for your arguments on this contract tort stockholder derivative action. That ends our hearing in 06 AP 1573, 06 AP 2290, Fryer versus Gilioli. The court is adjourned for the November sitting and should gather in closed conference at 3:15. Very adjourned.